It's not fair, said Michael, when Darren got twice as much pocket money as him. It's not fair, said Laura, when Gemma's mother picked her up from school. She wished it was her mother. It's not fair, said Jane, when she gave birth to a handicapped child. It's not fair, said Peter, when he broke his leg just before his team were to play a final match. It's not fair, said Mr. Brown, when Mr. Cameron won the election. It's not fair, said Mrs. Thatcher, as her mental faculties, once so acute, began to fail. It's not fair, said Beethoven, at the first performance of his Ninth Symphony, not a note of which he could hear. It's not fair, said Job, when God smited him with boils, even though he'd led a blameless life, obedient unto the Lord. It's not fair, said Ruth, when her trusted lover got her pregnant and then deserted her. It's not fair, said Charlotte Bronte, when her brother and her two beloved sisters all died within a year. It's not fair, said Tom and his friends, who heard that the government plans to make A-levels more difficult from now on. Well, sooner or later, we have to admit that life is not fair, although for some reason we can't help thinking it ought to be. Gradually we realise that if there's one thing we're not, it's born equal, despite the famous assertion of the American Declaration of Independence to the contrary. Unfairness arises due to inequalities. Darren getting more pocket money than Michael. It's unfair. Darren can buy the latest toys and games, Michael can't. Michael feels there's just nothing he can do. Life just doesn't seem fair. Then perhaps one day, Michael's dad will start earning more, and his son will then get more than Darren. But there are inequalities that aren't going to change, like if you're injured through an accident and suffer permanent damage. That life is unfair arises too from a sense of injustice, seeing that justice hasn't been done, like when Sarah's given the golden star, even though everyone knows Shane's work is better. Or when someone is promoted for reasons other than ability and worth. Or when elections are rigged and the wrong people assume power. Or when an innocent man is put into prison. Buddhism calls it dukkha. This sense of things not being fair, it's a major aspect of dukkha. The dukkha of an unfair world. Dukkha means unsatisfactory or downright painful. And human life is like sitting in a chariot with an ill-fitting wheel. We sort of bump and bounce along. Things do not go smoothly. And the question is, what to do about it? Well, that's the title of this talk. What to do in an unfair world. The title came to me and I thought, that's rather a good title. So I sent it to Elaine. She put it on the website. And then I thought, now I've got to give a talk about it. And I wondered, yes, what is one to do in this unfair world? Because it's very easy to let it get you down. It's very easy to get despondent. It's very easy to start feel, well, what's the use? Or to feel bitter, or feel envy, or feel resentment. There are people who go through very difficult times and don't get bitter or resentful, and they command admiration. There are outstanding examples like Nelson Mandela, the first post-apartheid president of South Africa, who was imprisoned for 27 years, mostly on Robben Island, and who urged forgiveness and reconciliation when he was released. There's the Dalai Lama, of course, who has refused to condone violence and hatred, and the hatred that underlies it, in his response to the atrocities inflicted on the Tibetan people since the invasion or annexation of Tibet by China. Thought also of Aung San Suu Kyi. And there are the people who we happen to know who keep cheerful despite many adversities and difficulties. I spoke to my mother last week. She'll be 80 next year, and though still in good health, she lives in sheltered accommodation. Old age, sickness and death are a prominent feature of her life. So I asked her how her week had been, and she told me, yes, that week she'd been to three funerals. Three funerals, and she said she hadn't managed to get to the fourth, so four of her friends, acquaintances had died. And she'd been with her old next-door neighbour who'd had a fall and gone with him into the hospital. So that's quite something. She sounded quite accepting. She just seemed concerned to do as best she could. She wasn't railing against the world. So perhaps there is a clue. She wasn't railing against old age or illness or death, but accepting there they were. Last Sunday we celebrated Parinirvana Day here. That's why we've got a white shrine here. It's the day that commemorates the Buddha's passing away. And some of the members of my Mitra study group commented next day how unusual it was to have a whole day talking about and reflecting on death. How actually it had been really quite enjoyable and even uplifting. And one person had to laugh because she took her notebook, she'd been noting things down during the talks at the Buddhist Centre, and she took her notebook to work next day and was relieved to find the sheet of paper she'd stuck in her notebook didn't fall out because it was called Planning My Funeral. We'd spent a session planning our own funerals quite cheerfully, I may say, but it would have been perhaps a little surprising to her colleagues at work if they'd asked, how was your weekend? And she said, well, it's great, I've been planning my funeral. I think we Buddhists have an advantage here because death for Buddhists is something natural and normal and not to be hidden away, not to be spoken about in hushed voices or anything like that. It's as normal a part of life as birth. And in fact, though for some Westerners this is not an easy thing to get one's head around, but according to the traditional Buddhist view of life, rebirth takes place over and over again, which means our stream of consciousness has been through the process of death and rebirth many times, as it were. So, in a way, it's nothing new. And we're also rather lucky, because we aren't in the position of thinking there's an almighty God deciding our fate, when and how we are to die. It was sometimes very difficult to understand how an all-loving God, as he was supposed to be, could devise such grim and terrible deaths, especially for his own believers, in the form of various persecutions and so on. And then one was supposed to love this all-powerful and vengeful God, which gave rise to a whole host of confusing and conflicting feelings. So for Buddhists, there's nothing like that going on. There's no God up there deciding our fate. Death is natural. It comes when it comes due to all sorts of conditions coming together. Still, sometimes when death comes suddenly or to someone very young or in some very terrible way, we feel the tragedy of it. We feel keenly, once more, that it's not fair. So I think, coming back to our question of what to do in an unfair world, well, first of all, we have to accept that the world is unfair. It's riddled with inequalities, and so often people do not get what seems due to them. So we see injustices all around, and we have to somehow accept this is the case. This world is a very unfair world, and we experience this as painful. Well, that's where the Buddha began. He said, there is dukkha. Simply that, there is dukkha. It's a fact. We all recognize it. Life is painful and unsatisfactory. Sangharakshita, the founder of this community, this Triratna Buddhist community and teacher, he gave a talk many years ago, and it's called Where Buddhism Begins and Why It Begins There. That's a good title, isn't it? Where Buddhism Begins and Why It Begins There. Well, he says it doesn't begin with an idea or a concept. It's not in the beginning was the word, or as Faust in the great play tried out, in the beginning was the deed. No, in Buddhism it all begins and ends with experience. Because, well, no one can argue with experience. If you're having an argument and someone says, well, that's my experience, end of argument. So the Buddha's teaching begins with an experience, and that is the experience of dukkha. And the Buddha said, life is like that. It's riddled with unsatisfactoriness and even pain, physical and mental pain. Pain of toothache, the pain of loss, the pain of knowing what we now enjoy will one day be lost. So pain is inherent in existence. It's nobody's fault. Things like illness arising, it just happens. And to take a dramatic example, think of the tsunami in 2004 that swept away so many lives. Yeah. If you were on the beach, you got caught, and if you were lucky enough a bit further up, you didn't. I believe some people said it was the wrath of God, But the geologist said it was the movement of tectonic plates. No one's fault. But how unfair on many lives. So when the Buddha says there is dukkha, it exists, this is his first noble truth. There is dukkha. And he said two more things. He said you can do away with much of the pain you experience as soon as you see that you're bringing some of that pain in reacting to the original pain, yeah, whether physical pain or mental pain. So he said you can stop reacting to the pain and causing yourself more pain. And then secondly, he said, you can come to a different understanding of pain, to a different experience of it. It can't go away completely, so long as you have a physical body. The Buddha himself experienced physical pain in his last days. But mental pain, that we can do something about, if you learn how to work with your mind. And I can show you how, said the Buddha. There's quite a lot about pain at the moment, but it does move on, don't worry. So let's remind ourselves about the pain that arises when we react to pain. We react against the pain, we're angry with the pain, we don't want to feel the pain, or else we start almost to wallow in it and to identify with it, to see nothing but the pain. I believe in breath works, which they do breath works courses here, which is dealing with pain. People who have physical, chronic pain. In those courses, they talk about this quite a bit. And they say, well, there's always more in one's experience than just the pain, so you can broaden out your awareness. And instead of reacting angrily, resenting it, try and be open to the experience, not hugging it to one, but exploring, noticing, investigating. What is it, actually? Physical sensations? Emotional tone. Bring in the higher faculty of mindfulness, the awareness that has perspective, that sees with perspective and remembers that things will change. And we have some helpful methods to bring to bear on our experience. We can chant mantras, we can talk to someone. These two help the mind to broaden out its experience. So that along with the pain come elements of pleasure. I'm not saying, of course, that if we're in physical pain we shouldn't do all we can to reduce it, but I'm talking about the pain that we can't get rid of. And this attitude of broadening out our experience can apply also to the pain we feel when life seems to be unfair. And so easily there comes the reaction, the feelings of disappointment, resentment, bitterness, powerlessness. Think of any of Shakespeare's tragic heroes, Othello, Lear, Hamlet, Macbeth. They all have a grievance concerning the unfairness of life. And they all react in their various ways that in the end cause their own terrible fall. Well, we don't want to end up like them. So let's instead look to our faculty of mindfulness. Bring in awareness that looks and investigates and sees more deeply into our own mind. And see how the mind is locked into a state of reactivity towards the original pain, and then we can do something about it. Remind ourselves the mind will change, the situation will change. Of course, that's also the Buddha's teaching, all things are impermanent. So that's one thing we can do when we experience the sharp pain of unfairness and stop ourselves bringing upon ourselves the secondary suffering of reacting to our experience of pain. Secondly, we can remind ourselves again and again that our actions have consequences. If we act out of bitterness, resentment, envy, and powerlessness, that will increase our suffering and bring suffering to others. All these emotions poison our mind, so as soon as we notice them, it's worth taking action. See if we can get back to the point before we started to rail against experience for being unfair. Back to the point where we simply experience the pain of a situation. If we can just stay there, neither pushing it away nor clinging to the experience of pain, but just noticing it, acknowledging that we are just acknowledging it, then we're with the Buddha and with his first noble truth, as I said, the noble truth of dukkha. And if we just stay there, then something new comes into play. It's like that ray of sunshine breaking through the clouds, so that you have to stop and breathe deeply and realize beyond all the clouds there is the sun. That ray is what Buddhists call Shraddha. Sometimes Shraddha is translated faith, but I'm cautious about using that word because so often faith equates in people's minds with belief. And as a Buddhist, you don't have to believe in anything, at least not in anything you can't verify in your own experience. I prefer the description of Shraddha that says it's the ultimate in us resonating with the ultimate in the universe. It's a reminder that there's a whole other way of being and experience of life. It's an intimation of the Buddha's third noble truth, that there is a possibility, which he knew for himself, of going beyond dukkha. It's like when an aeroplane takes off on a grey, wet, miserable day, and for a while one is immersed in the clouds, and then suddenly you're out, and flying above them in the clear blue, the sun illuminating the sky, and below, instead of a dreary grey mass, the clouds have become billows of water vapour. The grey mass of clouds is our mind when it's reacting with resentment and bitterness and confusion. And when we burst through into the clear blue, it's because, well, firstly we've accepted life is unfair, we've acknowledged the pain in our experience, we've taken on board the first noble truth, and secondly our minds have opened up to something that is beyond the usual realm of life as we know it, beyond the usual categories of fair and unfair. And when we get even a small taste of that open blue sky, we find we're able to look at our experience from a new perspective, to investigate it a bit more deeply. If we start to look more closely, we will see that much of the unfairness we experience, well, it's actually quite illogical. And it relates to our experiences of pain and pleasure, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and infamy, or fame and obscurity. Being human beings, we long for pleasure, we long for gain, we long for praise, and we long for fame. And we dread pain, loss, blame, and infamy or obscurity. So we chase after one, and we do all we can to avoid the other. But it seems it's in the nature of things that in our lives we will experience both. We'll experience pleasure, and we'll experience pain. We'll experience gain, and we'll experience loss. We'll experience praise and we'll experience blame. Some of you will have recognized this list. They're called the eight worldly winds and they blow through all our lives. I'm sure there isn't anybody here who's not experienced all eight of them in one way or another. And often our sense of unfairness comes because we expect the one and don't want the other. But it seems they only go in pairs. Wherever there's a pleasure of a worldly kind, sooner or later it's followed by pain. Wherever there's gain, it will eventually be followed by loss. You may know Thomas Mann's Buddenbrooks, a German novel, well, it's obviously translated into English. It was published in 1901 when he was only 26. That's just by the by. That's of interest to me, perhaps. But the novel traces the fortunes, or rather the decline in fortunes, of what at first is a very rich and confident Lübeck family. But over the decades, the family fortunes gradually fail. So you see, from gain to loss. Or again, we see how easily one can go from fame to obscurity. It's a theme of the recent film The Artist, which some of you may have seen. So there, the celebrity of the silent movies, when the talkies come, he just disappears. That's not the end of the story, but I won't tell you more in case you haven't seen it yet. Clearly, so long as we look to pleasure, gain, fame, sooner or later the opposite will come and we'll feel that life is not fair. Equally for praise and blame, we are generally so desirous of praise and find it so painful to be blamed. I hardly need give you examples of that. I'm sure you can all furnish examples from your own experience. Yes, what a world we find ourselves in, and whatever are we to do? Well, we need to get out. The world is unfair and we need to get out, so to speak. Well, we don't have far to look. The Buddha declared he'd found a way. That was his fourth noble truth. He said he'd found a kind of existence that was outside the blowing of the worldly winds, while the worldly winds had no hold or no effect. So the way there was his fourth noble truth. And the fact that there is another kind of existence was his third noble truth. That there's the possibility of the cease of pain as we ordinarily experience it. So the Buddha said, yes, there is another kind of existence, though perhaps experience is a better word, where all grasping after pleasure, grasping after gain, grasping after praise, and grasping after fame have been relinquished, and the desire for all those things has been let go. I don't know if you can imagine that, but if I try to imagine that, I immediately get a sense of freedom and even relief. The Buddha pointed out how pain arises from clinging. This was his second noble truth. He pointed out the cause of our pain, and he said, it's basically clinging. Clinging to what we like, wanting things to be a certain way. And he pointed out the joy that arises from letting go. And he encouraged his disciples to train themselves in letting go and to see for themselves whether they did not experience a different kind of happiness. Not the kind of happiness you get from accumulating things and people and accolades, but the happiness of giving them up, the happiness of simplicity, the happiness of giving, the happiness of loving without wanting anything back. That sounds pretty difficult, said his disciples. Well, the Buddha didn't say it was easy, but he said trying to find lasting happiness in an unfair world was even harder. In fact, it is impossible. The Buddha didn't just speak in terms of letting go and giving up. He also spoke in terms of bringing into being. He spoke of the creation of a different kind of mind, and he said that kind of mind was characterized by various wonderful faculties. And he said that anyone with a mind, that's right, anyone who has a mind, can develop them. He spoke of mindfulness, which I've already mentioned, and which in a way stands central to it all. Simply be mindful. Pay attention to your experience, the Buddha said, and all the rest will follow. But to do that, you need confidence and faith that there is something higher, that sense, that intuition that beyond the cloud the sun is shining and that it's possible to get there. It's confidence or faith that gives you the courage to let go of the things you've relied on, even though they bring pain, even though you know they are unsatisfactory. So you need faith to let them go and try something different. Perhaps to leave a difficult situation and create something far more positive, that needs faith. And it needs energy. That's another of the Buddha's faculties that he mentioned. Energy in pursuit of the good. Not just bodybuilding energy. That has its uses, but perhaps rather limited ones. No, energy of one's whole being. That is energy bent on the good. And bent on the good in Buddhism means bent on attaining wisdom, so you can act with compassion. And the Buddha spoke of the faculty of meditation, out of which the faculty of wisdom can arise. So these five mental faculties are worth remembering because the Buddha encouraged people to develop them. Mindfulness, faith and confidence, energy in pursuit of the good, meditation and wisdom. Now you may be thinking at this point, does that mean if you're a Buddhist, you just work on your own mind, embrace spiritual happiness, and sit back and watch the world go by, thinking, well, the world is an unfair, unjust place, I have to accept it, with your mug of cocoa at your side, put on the news, and think, well, the world is unfair, but I'm safe and sound. Well, clearly, it's not like that. That's not the example of the Buddha. Once he was enlightened, he spent the rest of his life concerned with others. In fact, trying to communicate to them the way out of the net of suffering. And he encouraged his disciples to do the same. Go ye, O bhikkhus, and wander forth for the gain of the many, for the welfare of the many, in compassion for the world, for the good, for the gain, for the welfare of gods and men. Proclaim, O bhikkhus, the Dharma glorious. Preach a life of holiness, perfect and pure. This quotation from the Mahavagga, one of the Buddhist scriptures, stands on the first page of each issue of the Mahabodhi Journal, which Bhante Sangharakshita edited for 14 years, which I've been working on recently. The journal was established in 1891, and the first editor was Anagarika Dharmapala, a Ceylonese by birth, and an extraordinary individual. Among other things, he travelled the whole globe. This was in the 19th century, or the early 20th century. The very first Buddhist to do that and take the Dharma to several continents. He was the first person to teach the Dharma in America in 1893 at a Parliament of World Religions in Chicago. He took the injunction of the Buddha to take the Dharma out very, very seriously indeed. He took it quite literally. And someone else who took the injunction very seriously indeed is Bhante Sangharakshita, who gave his first Dharma talks in his early 20s and has continued year after year after year unabated. Those two exceptional individuals felt deeply that what the world needs is the Dharma. Only the Dharma can really help human beings find the way that leads out of the mire of unsatisfactoriness, the web of unfairness, and all that feeling of all that the feeling of unfairness gives rise to. When Bhante was editor of that journal, he certainly did not stand back and keep quiet when he saw injustice. He spoke out on the issues of the time. He exposed neglect of governments or agencies that was bringing about suffering. He expressed the values of the Dharma, which are, you might say, truly human values. I wonder if someone could get me a glass of water. Thank you. So our attitude to an unfair world. Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. Our attitude to an unfair world or an unjust world is to stand up and speak out in whatever way we can, to express the values of the Dharma, to try and make the world, in whatever way we can, in however small a way we can, more in line with the real or true values, the values that regard what is most essential about human beings, is that they're capable of enlightenment, and encouraging attitudes and behaviour more in line with the enlightened consciousness. So we can do it in quite small ways, like supporting vegetarianism, refusing to buy animal products. We can do it by not gossiping and backbiting and sticking up for those who speak the truth. Oh, I'll have two. Oh, yes, it's yours, thank you. Stephen Covey, the author of that now famous book, The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, spoke of the difference between the circle of influence and the circle of concern. It's quite a useful distinction. You work out where you actually are able to have a direct influence and put your energy into that, while still acknowledging that your concerns go much further. You might feel extremely concerned about what is happening in Syria, but you're not able to do that much except to perhaps sign a petition calling on those in power to take action. But in our place of work, in your place of work, you can have a big effect by, well, doing whatever you can do. Buddhism says that ultimately there's only one cure for suffering, and that is enlightenment, and that therefore we can help the world most by doing all we can to create conditions where people can move in that direction, make the world a better place in Buddhist terms. Ultimately, it means passing on the, well, you could say the secret of the Dharma. And there are many ways to do that, by word and by deed, and by creating a different kind of world, a world that encourages the creativity of mind. That's really what we're trying to do here at the Birmingham Buddhist Centre, create a different kind of world, a world based on the values of the three jewels. The Buddha, who reminds us that human beings can gain enlightenment, the Buddha's Dharma, or teaching, and the Sangha, or spiritual community of the Buddha's disciples. So here I want to mention something in connection with Sangha. We may be working on our own mind, and doing all we can to transcend the lower mind that reacts to pain and to cultivate the higher mind, to bring the five spiritual faculties I mentioned into being. And we may feel deep compassion for the world and be moved to want to do all we can to change things. But one person can't do very much for the world. A whole order of people can do much more. And that is one raison d'etre for the Tri Ratna Buddhist order, the men and women working together to create a world where the Dharma can be practiced, where people can actually go for refuge. You may have heard of the figure of Avalokiteshvara, an archetypal figure who is said to be the embodiment of compassion. There's a well-known form of him where he's depicted with 11 heads and 1,000 arms, rather a strange sight perhaps until you know the story. Avalokiteshvara was a great bodhisattva, which means he was dedicated to attaining enlightenment not just for himself, not just so he could go beyond suffering, but so he could help all living beings. He wanted to help all living beings, and so strongly did he feel that wish, great urge to take away the suffering of living beings, that he made a great vow to his teacher, the Buddha Amitabha. He said it didn't matter how long it took, he would keep working until he had saved all beings, and if for one moment he faltered in his commitment, then let his body be shattered into 1,000 pieces. So with great energy and dedication he went about helping people who were suffering all sorts of difficulties and dangers and diseases. He tried to help them in the ordinary way, because obviously you don't give a starving person the Dharma, you give them food. He did all that and taught people the Dharma as well. But there were so many people, and often those he tried to teach did not seem that interested. And there were so many difficulties and so many problems, and it seemed he was getting nowhere. And for just one moment he wavered and began to think there was no point in carrying on. At that very moment, due to his vow, his body shattered into 1,000 pieces. He cried out to his teacher in agony. Amitabha came to his aid. Gently he brought the shattered pieces together in a new form, so that Avalokiteshvara now had 11 heads to look out in every direction, and he had 1,000 hands to participate in all the work of helping beings. And each hand had an eye, so that he could see with wisdom. Each hand held a different implement with which he could perform the great work. This image has been said to be an archetypal sort of equivalent to the Tri Ratna Buddhist order on its highest level. Pantisangharakshita indicated that, essentially, ultimately, that's what the order is. When the order is really being the order, it's Avalokiteshvara. Each arm represents an order member, each with the eye of wisdom, because each person must develop wisdom for themselves. And each holds a particular implement, just as each order member offers to the world something distinctive. Some people might be doctors or nurses or teachers. Some people are poets or musicians. Some people build houses. Some people are opticians. Others make money to spread the Dharma. Others work with the poor and illiterate. Others teach the Dharma. So together, if the order really manages to be an order, it can give a great deal to the world, far more than one person working on their own. But it gives something that is even more than the sum of its parts. One thing that's a great cause of pain in the world is division, hatred, enmity, even small misunderstandings. So when the order is really being the order, perhaps it doesn't yet manage that very, very often, but perhaps sometimes it does. But when the order is really being the order, it has risen above the things that are the cause of enmity and hatred and so on. I don't mean there is uniformity or that everyone has the same opinion about things. I mean there's no hatred, no enmity, no animosity, no competitivity, no envy, all those things. Bhante is this... Bhante has described three kinds of consciousness. that of the group member, that of the individual who's freed him or herself from the group, and then another mysterious kind of consciousness for which we have no word in English or most European languages, except apparently possibly Russian. He said it's the consciousness that arises when individuals come together and transcend their separateness. They don't merge into a group, into a group consciousness. Their individuality is still distinct, but they transcend separateness, and there emerges, he says, a third order of consciousness, which is true Sangha. And that, it is said, is an incomparable source of goodness to the world. And there we've transcended all sense of fair and unfair. We're in quite a different realm altogether. A realm where perhaps at last we feel truly fulfilled as individuals and able with others to create a juster world. Well, I'm describing to you or trying to give an indication to you of an ideal to which we're striving, towards which we're striving. And in the meantime, we treasure those moments when we experience, however briefly, whether order members or not, that coming into being when a number of people come together and something like the third order of consciousness arises. Might be in a study group, even on an evening like this. Those moments give us confidence it is possible. And though we may have a very long way to go before that becomes our natural habitat, the main thing is we're moving in that direction. The main thing is we've begun to see that though this world is an unfair world, there is something we can do about it. There is the call of the Buddha.